So I want to actually take you back to that dream batting lineup in 2003. It's not just Sachin, but all those guys. You would have seen something in them.
I spent almost every waking minute with Sachin. The entire World Cup, he never faced a single bowler. I was the only person who threw balls to him for the entire World Cup. Ganguly took wet tennis balls just to practice the bouncer because he knew everyone was going to bounce him. Shoaib Akhtar, Andrew Caddick, all of them are going to bounce him a lot.
About the guys who don't perform and eventually don't have a great career, what goes wrong?
When Dhoni was the wicketkeeper, no other wicketkeeper was looked at for a decade. Why? Because that position was taken. When Virat's batting at 3 or 4, we're not going to look anywhere else for a 3 or 4. So sometimes it's timing.
You've also worked in the IPL. Why is it that the juniors need to perform for you to win a tournament though?
Because generally they bring that something special to it. And it's that player who lights it up. When Shubham Gill did it, or Jaiswal did it, or KL Rahul did it for Kings XI, then that team's having a really special IPL that year.
Have you ever had to tell any of your athletes to stop sleeping around?
They're not being policed as much, but for sure, there's not these copious amounts of alcohol being drunk and parties and women coming back.
Do you think it's an outcome of bad leadership at the management level?
It's very difficult to manage an IPL team. Because you've got multiple egos, multiple status.
I've podcasted with more than 600 different people. What I've figured through the course of these 600 episodes is that the athletes that I've spoken to have some of the best mentalities that I've come across. Today's episode is a breakdown of what high performance really means with one of the world's top sports psychologists. Shamal Vallabhji is a veteran of the sports psychology space. He's worked with Kings XI Punjab, the IPL team in 2018. He's currently working with the Indian football team. He's worked in other sports like tennis as well. He's the guy you turn to if you truly want to understand the depths of sports psychology. What I will say on a personal level is that my greatest education as a professional, as a leader, as a content creator, has come from the world of sport, has come from studying sports interviews and sports documentaries. This particular podcast enhanced my understanding of what mentality truly means. So whether you're a cricket fan or whether you're just someone looking to better their own mind, I promise you, this is a power-packed podcast for all the potential professional athletes out there, as well as the potential greats out there. If you think you're a great and you're going to leave a massive legacy in this world, you need the tools to be able to build that legacy. That's what I've tried to bring you through this episode. I enjoyed the heck out of it. I'm sure you're going to enjoy Shamal Vallabhji on TRS. Shamal Vallabhji, this is a conversation I've wanted to have for the longest time because I saw you 10 years ago doing a segment on Star Sports about the psychology behind our nation's cricket players. So today is partially a cricket special and we're going to talk about some of your cricket perspectives, but it's primarily a sports psychology special. I'm very excited to speak to you.
Thank you so much, Ranveer. I'm a big fan of the work you do, the shows. I've learned so much through the conversations you had. So it's an absolute honor to be in front of you today.
No, I saw you 10 years ago. And the first question that popped in my head was that why hasn't television given you your own TV show where you're breaking down cricket psychology more? Because as a viewer, that's the part in the whole show that I was the most gripped because of. And that's what we're going to do today.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
What TV couldn't do, I hope that YouTube can. Because people in our country, and I think all over the world, love cricket conversations. All the cricket fans in the world love it when we speak about the icons that we've seen. But you've seen it from a very different lens. You've seen it from the locker room. I believe you were a part of the 2003 Indian World Cup team.
Correct.
You were helping them with their sports psychology.
Correct. Yes, absolutely.
And you've also worked in the IPL. You've also worked with international athletes. You've worked with other sports. So all I want to say is I'm very excited, as you can tell.
Thank you very much. No, I'm delighted to be here. And what you've said hits the nail on the head. I think the audience are hungry to understand what goes on inside the mind of a champion. And it's the next frontier for Indian sport in itself as well. If we can unlock this for our athletes, we'll see phenomenal growth in terms of our Olympic athletes and elite athletes on an international stage.
Yeah. We began doing a lot of cricket podcasts last year. The first detailed one I did was with KL Rahul. And that whole podcast was about me trying to unlock his mentality. Those are the questions I always had for the cricketers that I watch.
Yeah.
And he was happy to answer them. And he said that I enjoy the questions because for the first time, someone's trying to get into my mind through questions. And those were just the general fan questions I was asking.
Correct.
So I think that podcast got received very well by the audiences because of this reason, that there's a whole mental side of the game that television can't possibly show you. And perhaps podcasts or documentaries are the only mediums because of which you can understand the psychology of a top level athlete. So first, very straight up question to you is that in your entire career working with cricketers, who's the one cricketer who you thought was the mentally toughest one?
Such an interesting question. Firstly, to answer this question, you must know, I grew up in South Africa and I grew up in an era where the cricketers were all tough. Alan Donald, Jonty Rhodes, Gary Kirsten, Andrew Hudson, Sean Pollock. This was the era that I grew up in. All of them were phenomenally tough. I think one of the toughest athletes that I've seen mentally was Gary Kirsten. Gary Kirsten, who we know took India to the 2011 World Cup final and won it. If you ask anyone, including himself, he'll tell you, he was not the most talented, but he was without a doubt the hardest worker. And sometimes he came out of a batting session battered and bruised, but he just was relentless in making sure that he was not going to give his wicket away. And why is this so remarkable? Because he played in an era where there was absolutely no focus on the psychology. We only focused on the physical training and we focused on technique. And there was absolutely nothing that was pointing towards developing psychology. So that grit, that toughness came in from the cultural ecosystem, came in from the schooling, came in from in there. And we're seeing this really and truly evolve. Virat is probably the best example in India of someone who has the mental resilience and toughness to just keep everything aside. And for the audience listening, what is mental toughness? Mental toughness is the ability to keep all distractions aside and stick to a process, stick to the simple things that are going to make you a champion.
Okay. Do you still watch a lot of cricket?
I do, of course. Okay. Love it.
So did you watch the MCG game, the India-Pakistan game, where Kohli played that super innings?
Yes, absolutely.
So I was in the stadium that day. Biggest blessing of my life, just by chance. It was one of the most heated atmospheres that I've seen in any sports arena that I've ever been in. And I've been for football games. I've been for the World Cup final as well, the football World Cup final. But I felt like the heat in that India-Pakistan game was more because of the geopolitical tensions involved as well, because of the rivalry.
Of course.
The MCG is a massive stadium. Okay. And I remember by the 10th over of the Indian innings, I was telling some of the Aussies who were with us that if we win from here, this is probably going to be one of the greatest cricket matches of all time. And that's actually what happened.
Correct.
But the reason I said that was because of the atmosphere. It just seemed unlikely that we'd win. We were in a very bad position in such a massive stadium with that kind of a vibe going around with the fans, with that kind of tension. And he still made us win.
Yeah.
Everyone knew by that point that Virat Kohli has one of the best mentalities that we've ever seen in the sport. But that particular game, I think, really showcased his mentality on another level. So my question to you actually is, what is mentality? Is it just separating yourself from the crowd, from the results and focusing on the game? Is that what the average international cricketer struggles with? Because it's simple to put it as just hard work and grit. But I'm sure there's many, many layers when you break down this word that we call mentality.
Absolutely. It's such a great question. And firstly, we should understand that every single person will respond to pressure completely differently. Some people, when they come into the national team, that is a level, that's a step up that they need to perform at. So they'll do that. For a person like Virat, who is consistently at the national team and a national level, the step up for him is these big games, is the game against Pakistan is the game, which is a World Cup final, where the level, the pressure kind of dials up. And I think Michael Jordan says it beautifully, pressure, or it was Billie Jean King, pressure is a privilege. You know, the great athletes understand that. Why is pressure a privilege? Because when the pressure is at its greatest, the spotlight is also the biggest, which is the ability to get noticed. It's the ability to really rise up and make something truly, truly matter. So for a cricketer like Virat, these few games, India, Pakistan, World Cup finals, are rare opportunities that come once a year in his case, but in some athletes' case, once in a lifetime. What is mentality? Psychology is the tip of the iceberg, Ranveer. For Virat to do what he is doing, his physiology has to be supreme, which means his body fat needs to be below 10%. He needs to be physically fit, physically strong, cardiovascularly strong, because that's the foundation. The second thing is he needs to have complete confidence in his ability to execute a skill, because under pressure, he cannot think. It's just execution. Only when these two variables are in place does the mindset actually kick in. Because the mindset is just the cherry on the top. It's the tip of the iceberg in there. So for athletes like him who rise up in situations like this, they have a tick box of every single thing they're doing every single day of their life, which is the recipe to allow them to shine in these moments like this. And what is mindset? Mindset is just a trust in the process you repeat every single day. That's what it is. I was in the locker room when India played Pakistan recently with the football team and in that World Cup. The amount of pressure in that one particular game is absolutely phenomenal. And in fact, I was actually talking about this particular game a few weeks ago when I was breaking down the last World Cup and why we lost in the final. And it's a really wild theory, Ranveer, but I tell everyone, in every single World Cup, cricket World Cup, there are only two teams that I've ever met in every World Cup, and that's India, Pakistan. Why do we meet? We meet because commercially, it's the most profitable game for the entire World Cup. We all understand that. It makes sense. But I said, what we're not looking and what we're not seeing is because there's so much of pressure on that game, we all know that the more decisions you have to make, the more pressure it is, it's drawing from your willpower. Could it be that that one particular game saps so much from the team that we just don't have enough to push over the line when it really and truly matters? Could it be that? I don't know, but it's definitely something worth exploring.
Who's an Indian icon that you've worked with?
In the 2003 team, obviously we had everyone there. We had Sachin. We had, it was Ganguly, who I learned a lot from as a captain. Dravid was there. In Kings 11 Punjab, our captain was Ravichandran Ashwin. We had Glenn Maxwell. And then in CPL at St. Lucia Stars, Kieran Pollard was our captain. We had quite a few, actually. And then South Africa, the likes of Jonty, Sean Pollock, all of them.
So this is from the time span of 2003 to 2018, which is like 15 years.
I started with professional cricket teams in 1998.
Damn. So 20 years.
20 years.
What was the difference in your mind as a sports psychologist in 1998 versus 2018?
In 1998, the few things we knew was imagery. Visualization, go and visualize the perfect performance. We thought mental toughness was the ability to push past anything and everything. You know, mental toughness was your ability to constantly say, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it. Now, in 2018, we understand through neuroscience that a large part of how you show up is primal programming. A large part of how you show up is not so much the ability to push past it, but to understand how to actually use your brain to get an outcome. You know, it's about understanding motivation. It's about understanding primary drivers.
The issue is that when we talk about conversations related to mental toughness and going for the grind, a lot of people will retaliate saying that, no, you are promoting burnout, you are promoting stress. That's not what we're doing. I think the conversation about burnout should be limited to the fact that you need to have systems in your own life to prevent burnout. And that system can be subjective for everyone. If you want, take weekends off. If you want, go away, you know, for a week of travel once every 2 months, like yours truly does. but this is not a burnout oriented conversation. I mean, I don't want to talk about that stuff in this conversation, because for me, this whole conversation as we're moving forward is becoming about greatness.
Yes. Unlocking greatness.
Yeah, unlocking greatness. The key is, no matter what you're told and no matter what you think your ceilings are, the way your brain is hardwired biologically, you can actually change your whole personality to be able to achieve whatever you wish for.
Absolutely.
Sachin Tendulkar retired just before the onset of social media in India, according to me, which is why we don't see enough content around Sachin Tendulkar when we really should be seeing it.
Yeah.
You worked with him in 2003. I remember post-2003, for about 2 or 3 years, he had a little bit of a difficult period. Like, this is me as a cricket fan speaking. And he had come out of that. And the later phase of his career, he actually started flying again. He was a very, very key member of the Indian team. Won us a lot of matches. I remember there was one IPL season where he won the Orange Cap and all that. So he had kind of a bounce back in the later stage of his career. Brings me back to what you were saying about being in your 30s. And assuming that, okay, I've done the hard work, but what now?
Yeah.
The real champions reinvent even at that stage.
Yeah.
So I want to actually take you back to that dream batting lineup in 2003. It's not just Sachin, but all those guys. You would have seen something in them.
I saw so much. You know, you bringing back the story. That was, I worked so, I was, you ask anyone in that team, I spent almost every waking minute with Sachin. Because really interesting, nobody knows this. In the very, very first practice, we were playing the first game against Netherlands in Pal, right? That was the opening game for India in the 2003 World Cup. So in cricket, we try to save our bowlers. So we try to get schoolboy guys to just give the batters practice. It's a traditional thing, or the coaches would throw balls. So we got a big, strappy Dutch boy who came in, fast bowler, and he was 15 years old, very, very nervous. Sachin straps on the pads and he goes to bat first, but the wicket was slightly wet. Now, this guy was a little nervous. So John Wright, the coach, told him, you know, the pitch is not fully dry. It's a little damp. It's okay. I want you to pitch the ball up. But this young boy was very, very nervous. So the first ball he bowled was a bouncer and it flew over Sachin's head. All right. And John goes to him and says, son, pitch it up. So the boy was like, yeah, calmed himself down, took the ball again. He goes and he pitches the ball full, right, just at a forward defense length, and the ball hits a wet spot and pops up and wraps Sachin on the gloves hard, right, and goes straight up. So he takes his gloves out and he walks off the nets, Sachin does. So John calls to me. He says, listen, do me a favor, take some balls. I want you to throw to Sachin. Just go work with him alone. I threw to him for 3 hours. For the duration of the entire practice, I just threw balls to him. Everyone else was batting for 15 minutes. I threw to him for 3 hours. John comes after me, to me after the practice. He says, listen, for the rest of the World Cup, all I want you to do is just make sure Sachin's practicing well. And you ask anyone, the entire World Cup, he never faced a single bowler. I was the only person who threw balls to him for the entire World Cup. And the one thing, I had spent so much time, I learned with him. We practice every single situation. Every single bowler that he was going to face that could have threatened him, we created a situation in the nets between us that helped him practice for that. One of the reasons I think he had such a successful World Cup was because he had more batting time in the nets than anyone else by a country mile. He just hit that many balls. He hit balls that were brand new, balls that were old. We created multiple situations from there. You know, having learned that, the other interesting thing was these guys pick specific situations for specific bowlers and they practiced endlessly throughout that entire World Cup. Ganguly took wet tennis balls just to practice the bouncer because he knew everyone was going to bounce him. Shoaib Akhtar, it was Andrew Caddick. All of them were going to bounce him a lot. You know, the bowlers practiced a lot of swing when they came into against the South Africans. We practiced a lot of length coming in around the wicket. It was phenomenal.
When you were bowling to these guys, when you were bowling to Sachin, what was going on in his head?
Sachin was all about, you know, he was brilliant at understanding how much time he has. That was one of his key things. No matter what the situation was, he always told himself, we have more time than what the scoreboard's reflecting. We have more time than I actually think. The other interesting thing that greats have, whether it's Dhoni batting or Sachin or Kohli, they always know that the bowler's under more pressure than they are. They know this. They know that, you know, he's going to make a mistake. I just need to make patient. The probability of him bowling 6 perfect balls is 0. It's just about being patient. You know, they always knew this. So Sachin always tested himself. Sometimes he'd make me throw the ball from really, really short distance. Sometimes, you know, he'd make me use rackets and hit those bouncers at him. He'd try new balls. He'd tried old balls. We practiced every possible situation. We tested everything. Even when we played England at Kingsmead. Kingsmead was a bouncy wicket, Ranveer. We knew that everyone was going to try to get him on the back foot and they were hopefully going to get a leading edge to gully or to the slips. We knew that. The only solution he had was not to try to get above it, because there's no possibility of a short guy getting above it. It was to get underneath it. So what we particularly practiced and we did a lot of was increasing the width of his stance so that he's a few inches shorter in his stance. And he never even practiced keeping the ball on the ground. He practiced for 3 days clearing the inside ring over the top. You know, every single situation was that. You know, even Ashish Nehra, who got his career best, I think he got 6 for 23 at that game in Kingsbury. He spent hours just learning how to pitch the ball full on a wicket where everyone was going to pitch it short to extract bounce. You know, as one of the, that was my home ground, Kingsmead. I knew it better than anything else. And I remember telling Zahir and Ashish Nehra, I said, everyone comes to Kingsmead and thinks we need to pitch it short or we need to bowl back off a length because it's the bounciest wicket in the entire country. But honestly and truly, the way to get wickets here is to pitch it full and give it a chance to swing. These boys, listen, that's all they did. We cleaned England up in that particular game. So the interesting things that you take from sport, that you take from cricket, is that firstly, the strategy you use on day one is not the strategy that will win you a game on day two. You have to be radically adaptable. You have to be willing to change. You have to be willing to push the comfort zone of what you know and what you trust. And the second thing, and the last thing, sorry, is you have to understand what the team needs. Because at the end of the day, whether you believe it or not, if the mind share of the team believes that this is the way forward, you have to come in.
Okay. Couple of questions.
Yeah.
One, when you're working with these greats, be it Ashish Nehra or Sachin Tendulkar, is there an element of nervousness involved at that level?
Yeah. Yes.
The second sub question is about the guys who don't perform and eventually get dropped and eventually don't have a great career. What goes wrong? And is it linked to my first question?
The level of nervousness in playing against them, are you talking about me as an individual or other athletes?
I'm assuming that Sachin Tendulkar was nervous during the 2003 World Cup as well.
Yeah.
Even Sachin Tendulkar was nervous.
Sachin was always nervous because he understood. It comes back to the research I said earlier on. The great players understand the burden of responsibility on them to bring this home. They understand, they know it. So there's a phenomenal amount of pressure. Messi feels it. If you watch, there's a beautiful documentary on Netflix called Captains of the World.
Yeah, highly recommended.
Highly recommended. Brilliant. You saw it there. Isn't Messi said, oh my God, I have to bring this in. He said that. I have to bring this to Argentina. I owe it to my people. South Africa winning the World Cup, it's not about, I tell people, South Africa have won 50% of the rugby World Cups they've participated in. Why? It's the most phenomenal statistic in World Cups, in any sport. It's because they don't tell themselves, we give our best. They tell themselves, we have to do what is needed to get that result. So anyone is feeling pressure. The greats are feeling a phenomenal amount of pressure because they know everything is hedged on them, you know. And sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes that's a bad thing. I remember on the final of that World Cup, I woke up at 5 a.m. I was extremely nervous. And Javagal Srinath and Sachin Tendulkar were already down. And the game was starting much later in the afternoon. They were already down. They just couldn't sleep. You know, there was a lot of nervous energy in there because it mattered. It's exactly how we started the conversation talking about the current World Cup final. It's not an ordinary day. And when you tell yourself it's an ordinary day, you're lying to yourself and there's this mental tussle. You know, you're trying to convince yourself that a really special day is an ordinary day. Doesn't work. What is needed for those people who don't make it? You know, one of the best examples I'm going to give you, and maybe we'll show it to the audience when you're showing this, is the world of art. You know, I'm going to give you three examples that are beautiful. In 1917, there was an artist named Marcel Duchamp. He took a urinal and he put it on a wall and it became a masterpiece. Every other person that put a urinal in a museum was a plumber installing it in a toilet. A few years ago, an Italian artist by the name of Maurizio Cattelan took a banana and duct tape and stuck it on a wall. And he sold it for $120,000. And 6 months ago, Jens Hanning, an artist from a Nordic artist, got commissioned €84,000 by a museum to do two pieces. And he posted two blank canvases to them. Blank canvases. And he got paid $84,000. What is this an example of? This is an example of courage. To you and me, this looks ridiculous. We would never pay it. But it worked. Courage only rewards the first. The people who struggle to unlock greatness are the ones who are supremely talented, who are putting in the hard work. They lack the courage to try. They lack the courage to do something different. They lack the courage to listen to their heart because deep down they know what is needed. It's just, if it doesn't go right, how am I going to answer for it? But if it goes right, it's the end of the world. Courage is actually the thing that 99% of the people need a little more of. And courage is a byproduct of an ecosystem that's going to tell you it's okay if it goes wrong.
I'd asked KL about how he came up the ranks in a very competitive Karnataka Ranji ecosystem.
Yeah.
He thought a lot and then he answered by saying self-belief probably. He's like, hold on. Yeah, it was probably just self-belief. That's all he said.
Yeah.
Which is probably linked to what you're saying.
Yeah, it is self-belief. And it's also, you know, the Karnataka ecosystem is quite tough. You know, one of the guys I used to feel really sorry for was Karun Nair, who was with me at Kings 11. Karun, his last match he played for India, he scored 300 in a test match and got dropped, never got called again. He did nothing wrong. You know, the problem is that the Indian cricket ecosystem has such an expulsion of talent that you literally don't have to do anything wrong to not be looked at. That is the harsh reality of what it is. It's going to require something special. Also, it's a requirement of the time. And when Dhoni was the wicketkeeper, no other wicketkeeper was looked at for a decade. Why? Because that position was taken. You know, when Virat's batting at 3 or 4, we're not going to look anywhere else for a 3 or 4. So sometimes it's timing. And I know you're a deeply spiritual person. And the first lesson I teach all of my athletes, every single athlete of mine, this is the first thing I teach them, which comes from the Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 18, verse 14, Krishna tells Arjuna, there are 5 things needed for success. You have to be the right person for the job. You have to have the right tools available to you. You have to be in the right place. And you have to put in the right amount of hard work and effort. And he says, these are the 4 that are in your control. The 5th variable is invisible. It could be luck. It could be destiny. It could be all the energy that you have not done anything to that's helped it come together. He says, these are the 5 things needed for success. And he tells him, ego is the inability to recognize the 5th variable in your success.
Oof.
Powerful. Powerful. And humility is when you see it, right? So I tell athletes, you know, if you look at only the 4 variables, you're going to blame the whole world. There's a 5th variable and we have no control over it.
Yeah, I just sincerely hope that people are able to extract the best of this subject called sports psychology.
Yeah.
And try placing it into situations from their past and possible situations in their future. That's the actual purpose of watching sports documentaries, sports interviews, studying sports psychology.
Yeah.
That a lot of people miss.
Of course.
So anyway, coming back to this conversation, spoke about how you've brought in the Bhagavad Gita into your counseling. Is there another anecdote from the Bhagavad Gita that you've used with cricketers other than what you just spoke about?
Let me give you another interesting story, which is great. 2019, Wimbledon final. Okay, Novak Djokovic is playing Roger Federer. This final is special for three particular reasons. One is it's the longest Wimbledon final in the history of the competition. The second reason it's special is because it's the first final to be settled by a match tiebreaker. And it's special for the third reason because it's the first time the champion comes back from two championship points down to win it. And that was Novak Djokovic. And in his post-match interview, he said something beautiful. He said there was a moment in the stadium when every single person was screaming Federer's name. And he said, I had to go to a different place in my own mind to find strength. Coming back to your question about anecdote, there's a beautiful anecdote which I teach all of my athletes. And it's not come from the Bhagavad Gita. It's come from another beautiful book, which is Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. The Sage Patanjali tells us that there are five states of mind. Okay, it's called Sipta, Mudra, Vikshipta, Ekagra, Niruddha. The first two states of mind means you're a direct byproduct of your environment. Wherever I place you, you'll mimic that. The third state, Ekagra, means you're able to raise above it, but only temporarily. We all experience this. You do yoga for half an hour, 45 minutes. You're in a state of bliss for 30 minutes after that, and you're done off. You go back to the pressure. Niruddha is you're able to maintain that state of elevation for a prolonged period of time. We see this with a lot of our saints and yogis around. And the top, Niruddha, the main one, is you are so elated that you start to change the environment around you. Everyone starts to behave like you instead of you behaving like your environment. Now, I teach this to my athletes, not because it's an anecdote, but because it's a very, very powerful lesson that the environment is critically important in how you perform. What Djokovic taught us in that game is that not every environment will support you. And my athletes need to learn that. I'm teaching them that not every environment will be supportive. We've seen that even. Arjuna never felt supported in every single ecosystem. That was what Krishna was telling him. He says, you have to rise above what you're seeing and do your duty. So being able to discern between an environment that supports you and an environment that does not support you is critically important. And if you don't have the inner strength, the inner tranquility, when the external environment stops supporting you, it's the end of the road. For those who do cultivate it internally, it's the start of a brand new journey which unlocks so much more. So I teach this to my athletes because I tell them, right, that what is environment? Environment is every single person's responsibility in a team to raise the standards of where we are. I said, an environment is only as good as the energy you pour into it.
Okay.
Very, very important.
Keeping the 2003 World Cup team in mind, I am assuming that Ganguly had a key role in setting the tone for the environment because he was the captain.
Yes.
So a couple of questions. One, what did he do in that team? Because it is considered a legendary team. And the second question is, who were the other leaders in that dressing room and what did they bring?
Yeah. That was the 2003 World Cup team was really special because you had the senior players of Dravid, you had Virender Sehwag, you had Sachin Tendulkar, you had Javakal Srinath. Okay, and you had Sourav Ganguly. These were really the stalwarts, and Anil Kumble was there as well. But even Anil Kumble didn't play all the games. Then you had the youngsters. You had Mohammad Kaif, you had Yuvraj Singh, you had Harbhajan Singh, all of that. Why it was special and what makes Ganguly a truly special leader was that he gave all of the youngsters absolute confidence. He made the environment super comfortable and he gave them confidence. He gave them belief that they actually belong here. Now, this is the thing that you need to know about a World Cup. A World Cup statistically has shown us that the team with the most experience will go on to win. But in any World Cup, the senior players lay the foundation. It's the junior players who bring the win. It's always the senior players who lay the foundation for what's needed. It's the junior players who, if they put their hand up, you'll win. And you see this in every single World Cup that's ever happened. The senior players are always there doing what they expected to do within 10% of that. But every time something special comes in from a youngster, you sort of win it. Ganguly was brilliant at that. He created this beautiful canvas for the juniors to just be themselves, express themselves, and play with absolute freedom. This was what it is. I'll tell you a really interesting story. My relationship with him changed in one particular game. The game where India played Pakistan at Centurion. We go to the ground. It's a day game. And I know South African conditions really well. And I'm having a conversation with him and I'm telling him, we need to bowl first. Let's chase. He's like, no, we have to bat first. We have to put the runs on the table and put Pakistan under pressure. And I was really nervous because I know Centurion wicket gets better as you bat. I went to John Wright. I said, John Wright, you have to change his mind. I went to Sachin Tendulkar. I said, you have to change his mind. I went to Virender Sehwag. I said, you have to change his mind. I went to Anil Kumble. I said, you have to change his mind, who may not even have been playing in that game. Sourav Ganguly was headstrong. We're going to win the toss and we're going to bat and we're going to put the runs on the board. By the grace of God, we lost the toss. And Pakistan elected to bat. They made about 275. I'll never forget that. I'm sitting right in the front of the locker room on the top at Centurion. And I can see him coming like a beeline straight to me. Came straight up the stairs, came to me. He says, I told you they'd bat first. And I froze. But in that moment of freezing, I said, we'll win with two overs to spare. I don't know what made, I was literally petrified. I was shaking. And I just said, I win with two overs to spare. Right. I wasn't thinking, I don't know what happened. And that's exactly what happened. The wicket got better and we won with two overs to spare. Sehwag and Tendulkar opened the batting with what was a masterclass in how to open. You know, he scored 98, I think, in that game. And we had an over 100 run opening partnership. Set the foundation, beautiful batting track. And he walked up to me and he said, thank you very much. And that changed the relationship. Every time I said something, was there to listen. This story is really important because, you know, it's what we spoke of earlier. The courage for a person who is very, very fearful to just express themselves, to try, to say something, to do something different. We saw that with Yuvraj when they won the T20 World Cup when he hit six sixes. We saw that with Zahir Khan in that World Cup trying to do something different with the ball. Courage is what's really important. It's not going to feel easy at that moment. But if you do it, you know, the whole world sort of opens up to you. When we talk of Ganguly as a captain in that time, he gave everyone a ear. He listened to every single person. He walked around the room. He spoke. He listened to everyone. He created that environment for everyone to just be who they were. And that was probably one of the most unified teams I've ever seen or I've ever worked in.
What about the other leaders in the dressing room?
The other leaders all played a vital role. You know, Sehwag was very, very quiet, very, very reserved. Sehwag was the type of person who, you know, if you were next to him, you felt his energy. Anil Kumble took the spinners under his wing. He took Harbhajan under his wing. They practiced together. They spoke together. They ate together. The young batters, Mohammad Kaif, Yuvraj Singh, you know, you could see them sticking together. They would spend, Dada would call them aside, would spend a lot of time with them. Each one, we had micro captains. You know, Mohammad Kaif was our fielding captain. So this was another brilliant thing that John Wright did. John Wright, we knew we had a senior captain in Ganguly, but we created captains for each department who were juniors who were forced to speak. So we had Zahir Khan, who was a junior, who was leading the bowling attack. He was captaining Srinath. Then you had Yuvraj Singh captaining the batting unit, right? Giving him the courage to speak and tell the batters how to do it. And then you had Mohammad Kaif leading the fielding unit, and you had Harbhajan Singh leading the spinners. So what he did was he created micro-captain roles within an ecosystem that forced them to speak, forced them to bring their personality and their voice to the front, as opposed to leading from the shadows. Because if you leave a youngster, he'll migrate into the shadows. You don't want that. This was the genius of John Wright and Ganguly in terms of how we brought that team together.
What is the outcome of actually involving everyone in the team?
Belonging is the sense, is the critical thing in a locker room. And the fastest way to create belonging is to create equal talking time. Remember, in a locker room, there's always this hierarchy. It's not spoken about, but it is. Senior players are the ones who are expected to speak. They sit in the first positions. They do all of that. And juniors are always the ones listening. But like I said, it's the juniors who have to rise up to actually push that win over and to bring that title home. Now, they're only going to be able to do that if they're able to feel comfortable and they're able to express themselves. That is a byproduct of belonging. Belonging is the first step to psychological safety. And the locker room is the epitome of psychological safety. So the fastest way to create safety is to create equal talking time. Give people the opportunity to speak. And personality-wise, in any locker room you go, you'll find the newbies and the introverts will migrate towards the walls or towards the back of the room. They'll become quieter and quieter as tournaments go on. It's leadership. It's the psychological leadership that we use to bring these people to the forefront. So if you want to get someone to truly express themselves, you bring them to where the spotlight is or you bring them to the front of the room. Their focus goes up, their alertness goes up, and they probably speak a lot more.
Why is it that the juniors need to perform for you to win a tournament though?
Because generally they bring that something a little extra, something a little special to it. You know, a senior player knows what expected of him and everyone is planning for that. All of the opponents have already factored in that he's going to score this much runs, he's going to do this, he's going to bowl so many overs at this much runs. What they've not factored in is that extra special thing that a youngster would bring in. Someone who's hungry. And you see this even in IPL. Isn't every single IPL, you get some junior who comes in, lights it up, right? And he goes, you know? And it's that player who lights it up when Shubham Gill did it, or Jaiswal did it, or KL Rao did it for Kings XI. Then you're having, that team's having a really special IPL that year, you know? So when the junior lights it up, it's an X factor and it's unexpected. When it's unexpected, it catches everyone by surprise.
I was going to take this conversation into the domain of aging, especially for men, because I'm a guy and I'm noticing that a lot of my friends my age, like near my age especially, you know, 2 years give and take, everyone's going through similar problems, which is injury related. Suddenly we're having to incorporate new things into our workout routines. You know, mobility work, stretching, all the stuff that didn't matter 5-10 years ago. I have some friends who are cricketers, some friends who are footballers. They're all going through parallels of the same at a much higher level, at like a pro athlete level.
Yeah.
But all the guys in and around age 30 are going through some mental challenges. Everyone's suffering with something for sure. So it's either you're suffering with some kind of long-term physical injury, you're suffering with the fact that you don't think your career has panned out the way you wish for it. You're suffering from the fact that your childhood mental health issues are coming to the forefront, or something else to do with family. But there is a big bubble of suffering that's coming to the surface for many men around me, especially. And I'd argue that many women as well. But I see it more with the guys. I think this is just my own theory. I feel women are way better at dealing with their own mental health. At least in my circles, like all my female friends are much sharper when it comes to dealing with their own emotions. The guys get confused.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
No, it's true. I mean, if you're speaking about a general population, the reason why females are better at managing any situation is because they're better communicators. So anything that any female is going through, you can rest assured someone in an ecosystem, a friend knows about it because they've spoken about it and they've chatted about it. Males, half the time, even though they're close friends, you spend every single week with them, you have no idea what's going on because we just haven't found the courage or we don't know how to brace certain conversations until it's really, really crippling. So this is very, very common. The other thing from a neuroscience point of view is the blood flow in a female brain is consistent throughout the entire brain. So emotionally, what happens is when a female is experiencing emotion, that emotion affects every aspect of her functioning, whether it's work, it's relationship, it's parenting, it's everything. That emotion is present because of how the brain is experiencing blood flow. The male brain experiences blood flow in, I wouldn't say pockets, but in very focused areas, depending on the task that's needed.
Compartmentalization of thoughts.
Exactly. So if you're experiencing an emotion, right, you're able to very, very quickly divert focus and attention to something else and do that quite efficiently. So what's happening is because something is not prevalent in our ecosystem or in our thought process perpetually throughout the day, we kind of forget about it or we sweep it under the carpet. Females, because it's present, they're constantly looking for that solution. And sometimes that solution is in how they speak to each other. So what you've noticed in terms of males versus females is also neuroscience and neurobiology in how we're functioning. And there's an interesting way. Now, because we divert, what males forget is we think we've forgotten about it. But it's not. It's just there. And at some stage, we'll get back to it. And it could be tomorrow, 6 months, 1 year, 10 years later. You know, that's the problem, is that we have no ability to understand and process and disseminate it in that moment, which is why it affects us much later.
If you keep brushing things under the carpet, eventually the carpet will tear.
Yes, for sure.
Like, yeah, this is what I'm seeing with so many guys. I don't know. Again, it's an early 30s observation. Everyone's mental health issues are coming to the forefront and childhood issues are coming to the forefront.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they have a positive relationship with the parents now,
yeah,
but they probably didn't have one while they were growing up. All that's like bubbling up. It's causing a lot of, I don't want to call it trauma, but existentialism, reflective conversations around me. That's what
I mean. So trauma is a difficult word, like you're right. It's not the right word to use because not every experience was born from malice. Mm. And I do a lot of work with psychological safety, either in corporates and in the locker room with athletes. And I can tell you that psychological safety is very rarely eroded from a place of malice. It's actually eroded from a place of kindness. Everyone's trying to do the best, but it's the subconscious behaviors that are breaking the system apart. Like, for example, I'll give you a beautiful corporate example. A CEO who feels like I can answer the call at 10 o'clock in the night if someone calls is thinking to myself, I'm here for my organization. I'm organization first. I have an open door policy. Call me anytime. But every time he answers the call at 10, he's signaling to everyone else that if I'm the CEO and I can answer at 10, you should be available to answer at 10 as well. Now, none of it was done for malice. The intention was pure. But the subconscious ripple signal from that behavior has eroded safety in the organization, where everyone needs to be fully alert 24/7. It's as simple and as subtle as this. This is the thing with child psychology, and this is the thing with any psychology, is it's very, very subtle. Very subtle. Whether you're in a sports team with an athlete, whether you're looking at psychology, looking at trauma, very often, even the things that we experience from childhood, I tell people, be kind, because your parents didn't have harsh intentions. They had the best intentions. It's just that it played out in a different way. Sometimes the number one childhood trauma we find in athletes and in corporates is called subjugation. Subjugation means you were told no a lot. Every time you wanted something, you were told no. Now, when you peel below the layers of it, what happens is you were told no, not because they didn't want you to do it, but because they didn't have the resources to give you that opportunity. We all know this. We've all gone through this where you wanted something, your parents said no, not because they didn't like you, but because the resources weren't available. The byproduct of subjugation 20 years later in life is that in a corporate where you're a leader, every time someone tells you no, you have an inability to perceive why they're saying no, and you go hard to prove them wrong. So you feel like I have to prove the whole world wrong. You know, and that's the attitude you show up with every day. Now, it wasn't born from malice. It was born from love, you know, but the manifestation of it is that the whole world's against me.
I see this a lot with LeBron James. I remember after the Lakers won their championship, he said, "It's about damn time someone puts respect on my name." And this is the point in human history where he's already regarded as the greatest of all time.
Of course.
You're already the GOAT. I love you, LeBron, like with my whole heart. You've taught me so much about life. But there was no need to want respect.
Yeah.
Forget asking for respect. Why does your heart want that respect? You're LeBron James.
Yeah.
And that got me thinking a lot. I thought about him for the next 3 to 4 months. In terms of why is a guy like that asking for respect? He's LeBron James. He's the new Michael Jordan in so many ways. Yeah. And even he feels like that. It's got to be something that went on in his childhood.
For sure.
It's probably subjugation.
It's, you know, what you're saying is so interesting. I've had the privilege of working with some real goats in many, many fields. And, you know, I've noticed something really subtle with them. I spent 6-7 years on the tennis tour, and when I was there, Rafa and Federer were the two goats on tour everywhere. And Rafa was amazing, Federer was amazing, but you know, and I saw this and I recognized this when I spent a lot of time doing some work with Mr. Bachchan just down the road for many, many years. And I realized a goat, we use that term to describe their, what they've achieved in life. Okay. But there are two categories of people. There's a category of a person who's achieved a hell of a lot, but needs the world to recognize it. And there's a category of a goat who's achieved the same amount and knows it. And they walk into every room, not trying to be recognized as a goat, but realizing that the 10 seconds you spend with them is going to change your life. So all they're trying to do is make that 10 seconds worthwhile for you. There are a few of these people who rise to that level. And those, in my opinion, are the real goats.
Damn. Oh, and if LeBron James was not able to reach that.
It's hard. And I'm sure he's there. I'm sure he's there in certain ecosystems. I'm sure he's there in certain environments. But I'm saying it's not about your achievement. It's just a level of maturity that comes in from the programming of your environment. You know, when your environment constantly gives you that safety and allows you to thrive in your achievements, you don't look for it outside. But if the ecosystem is not allowing you to thrive in what you've achieved, then you're always looking for those signals.
So Bumrah is the first bowler who's got the number one ranking in all three formats.
Correct. Yeah.
And the moment he got his final number one ranking, he put up a post which showed an empty stadium and then a stadium full of people cheering. So under the stadium full of people, the caption was, the applause. And under the photo of the empty stadium, he put up a caption saying, the support. Now, as a cricket fan, when I saw that, first I felt kind of bad that our goat bowler is thinking this way. And then my head dials back to a year prior where there are all these memes about Jasprit Bumrah coming out, which go like, ab to sharam kar le Bumrah. That was the meme trend. Meme trends, and I'm also a meme trend now, happen because of people being in the public eye. If you're in the public eye enough, eventually you will be memed. It's almost a validation of you being in the mainstream.
Correct.
But for an athlete to go through that while he's injured, of course he wants to come back and play for the country, but he's trying to get his body and his mind ready for it. A lot of fans won't show him the support. And I think he was talking about this whole meme phase where under every Jasprit Bumrah post, people are commenting saying, ab to sharam kar le Bumrah. Cricket meme pages were full of ab to sharam kar le Bumrah memes. But it's so unfair to international athletes.
Yeah.
And the counter argument to that is that's why they're celebrated and paid that much as well. That you're supposed to go through all this.
It's true. I generally never like to have this conversation and bring money in and how much they paid. You know, how much they paid is a byproduct of the work they put in. You know, I feel really bad when this happens. It happens to millions of athletes. Another, you using Bumrah as an example. Last week, the same thing happened to Rohan Bopanna. You know, 1 year ago, everyone was talking negatively. He didn't win a game for 5 months. He should retire. He's 42 years old. Now, he's the pride of India at 43, oldest Grand Slam champion, Australian Open champion, all sorts of things like this. The one thing I've recognized and I've seen with athletes, and the thing that I coach a lot in them, is it's so, so important to understand who's in your core inner circle, trust them and keep them close. Because that is all you can rely on when you hit the ground, when you're going through a trough. You know, it's very critical. Every single champion athlete, the reason why it's so hard to get a piece of them when they're winning is because you weren't there when they were losing. And they know this. They're not silly. They've seen it, you know. So when he became number one, yes, a million people, I can guarantee you, would have phoned him. But I can guarantee you, he would have probably returned 10 calls. The 10 people who were there when he was doing the rehab at NCA and he was injured. Every single athlete, this noise doesn't matter. They see it. We take notice. We hear it. Much like you as well. You hear it. It doesn't matter. But if the person who was there when you were just starting off all of a sudden says, I don't think you should have said something, you'll think twice about it. Why? Because he was there during the good and the bad. And this is critical. This is a very, very important lesson for everyone to learn. You know, what Bumrah is telling us right now is, you know, he's like, yes, you know, you're applauding here. Where were you when I needed you? But he didn't even need you when then, because he knew who was there and he trusted who was there. That ecosystem is essential for every single person, not just an athlete.
Shout out to Sanjana Ganeshan.
Yes.
I think a supportive partner.
For sure.
And I know that they've been together for a very long time now.
Yeah.
A supportive partner is so important for a successful career, both for men and women.
Of course.
You need like your partner to be your rock. And I don't know, would you argue that perhaps athletes who go through tough times sometimes are facing those tough times because of a not so supportive partner and or multiple partners?
You know, I can't comment on whether they don't have a partner that's supportive, but I can tell you that, you know, having that rock, having that supportive partner can be the determining factor with whether you get through it or how you get through it. Because when you're going through a dip, right, your entire mind fragments. You don't even recognize who you are anymore. You cannot trust any process. You cannot trust. And even you in your own home are not the same person.
Mm.
And what you think is difficult for you, I can honestly tell you, is 100 times more difficult for the person who loves you, who's sitting next to you. Because just like you don't recognize yourself, they don't recognize you. You know? And they have to put all of the inhibitions aside and trust what they saw when even you couldn't see it. You know? So I tell people that, you know, sometimes, and I've seen this in many, many cases, in entrepreneurs and in athletes, that when you trust the stability of a certain relationship and you pour into that, right, it repays itself back tenfold. And you'll never fully understand and appreciate it, okay, in the good times, but you'll thank your lucky stars during the bad times.
How does it pay you back tenfold?
It pays back tenfold because remember when you go when you're having a bad patch, when you're going through, there's anxiety, there's depression, there's a lot of external noise out there. You need an amplification of a positive voice. You need someone who recognizes certain things, someone who's going to create a safe ecosystem where you're not even talking about what's happening, where you can take your mind apart and you know, or move it away from that core subject in there. That's the one person that can do it. No one else can do it, you know. The only person that can do it is the person who's with you and feels safe enough, you know, to create that a nurturing ecosystem. Because you need it. Because why? You can't go on holiday, Ranveer, because you don't know how long you're going to be in that space. And you need to be in an environment where you can go and practice, but come home and let it all go. Mm. And you need to repeat that process, right? And you need to know, you need to be with someone who's going to keep every other agenda on the side till you recognize who you are and you come back again, right? If you've got a person who's constantly bringing different agendas in, you've got no chance.
Constantly bringing different agendas.
I mean, different issues, different things. If there's no trust in that relationship, if they're wanting different things, you need a stable emotional base. Stability, emotional stability is the foundation of all growth. We've learned this as a child. If you take a new child that comes in with their mum, in any new environment, he'll sit here first. When he feels comfortable, he'll explore, maybe go outside the door. Then he'll come back. When they feel a little more comfortable, then they'll go further. Then they'll come back. The mum is significance of emotional stability. You can only explore curiously from a base of emotional stability. So where's the emotional stability when you're going through turbulent times in your career?
Have you ever had to tell any of your athletes to stop sleeping around or to recover from a breakup quicker?
I've not had to tell them to recover from a breakup quicker, but I have given many, many times a lot of guidance around the ramifications of what it means to be going out, to be sleeping around, to be consuming copious amounts of alcohol, and the amount of energy drain that it's taking from them.
I would assume everyone knows the physiology of consuming copious amounts of alcohol. I don't think everyone truly understands the outcome of having multiple sexual partners.
Yeah.
Especially the outcomes on the mind.
Yeah.
I do believe that there are outcomes. I observe this with some of my friends who have multiple sexual partners. There is a level of emptiness you reach if you make sex your drug.
For sure.
The narrative in Mumbai circles especially is that when you're an athlete, you have very high testosterone. You're basically hornier than usual.
Yeah.
So you'll hear this narrative flying around a lot that a lot of young athletes actually have a reputation for being a little horny.
Yeah.
I would assume that people need to be educated on the outcomes of listening to your horniness regularly.
So, you know, naturally, if you're young in your 19s, 20s, your testosterone level is significantly increased. That doesn't necessarily mean, and it's a green light to go and sort of sleep around and have multiple sexual partners. And spirituality also teaches us the power of, yes, you may feel one way of they looking at it is, okay, I have high testosterone, I need to express it. But spirituality teaches us the concurrent of that, where if you actually retain that, you find greater strength, greater clarity of thought. One is going outwards, the other is bringing it inside and channeling that. Now, a large part of what they're doing and the behaviors they're doing is just a byproduct of their youth, you know, and what they think is cool and the way they're doing it. A large part of this is also in the ecosystem around them. If there's an ecosystem around you that's advising you on the ill effects of something like this, then you're more likely to not do it. If you're surrounded with people who are doing it and it's deemed to be okay, then you'll constantly do it. The ecosystem for a young athlete is primarily the most important thing, you know? And that's the danger in Mumbai as such, because we live in a city where there's so much of stimulation around that it's easy to get distracted. But I've had to have conversations with athletes where, and I don't speak to them about, I speak to them on the deterrent effects of their physiology. But I think the thing that they get the most, Ranveer, is how it could impact their career if socially, if somebody speaks as such, you know, or if someone says something. I think that brings more fear than actually the physiological or emotional ramifications of this type of beer, which is scary.
Yeah. And this type of news spreads very, very fast.
Of course.
Like you hear all sorts of things about athletes in this city.
Yeah.
You know, when one has sex with another human being, there is an exchange of energy.
Of course.
What happens post the energy being exchanged in the receiver's mind? Because all sport and perhaps business also is a mental game after a point.
Yes.
Business is a mental game anyway, but okay, when we talk about sport, it's technique and physical fitness up to a certain level. If you're playing at the international level, it's almost entirely a mental game.
Correct.
That's what I've figured, at least about cricket. So if you have sex with someone in a casual manner, where it's a one-night stand, you're exchanging energies with that person.
Correct.
What stays about that person which makes its way to the cricket field?
There's a lot. There's you know, the entire energy state that they're in. If they've been, you know, if someone's been consuming a lot of alcohol, even if you've not, if they've been consuming drugs or not, the entire energy is completely depleted, isn't it? And now you've gone. So you've completely drained yourself in that there. Now, after that happens, right, what is your process? If you're not a spiritual person, if you don't understand solitude or don't have a spiritual practice, then you're a sitting duck. How are you going to actually raise your level out? Also, that person's left a mental impression on you, has left an emotional impression on you. Every single thing has done. In spirituality, we speak of the mental body, the emotional body, and then the physical body, you know, and then you have the aura body on top of that. So when something is affecting you physically, it's already penetrated through all these bodies in there. So when you have a sex, for example, as an act, right, you've had a physical act, but what is physical has already bypassed the energy, the emotional, the aura body to have that physical interaction, right? And it's either left a positive or a negative impact in you. And you have to be the sole judge of that.
This is a quick trick to gauge if you should be friends with someone or okay. should invest time in even a platonic relationship. And then obviously it applies to romantic and or sexual relationships. Always notice your energy levels after meeting someone.
Correct.
If you feel a rise in energy levels, they're probably meant to be in your life. And then a long-term version of that applies to romance and sex.
It's a really, really good sense. And I think one of the things that I'm really keen on doing, and I do a lot with my athletes, is I try to quantify the intangible stuff, right? So an intuition and is one of the things that is really, really intangible, but athletes need to rely on it a lot. So what I try to do is, and we'll come back to this here, I try to get them to, you know, you have this voice in you when you're a cricketer or assuming you're a Bumrah bowling, you know, it's that voice is saying, okay, I should bowl this or I should hit this spot or that spot. And you have an option, either listen or I don't listen. Okay. And if you don't listen, it's out. If you do listen, the outcome is either positive or negative. So I ask my athletes to track that voice of what it's saying, whether you're listening to it and whether the outcome is positive or negative. And over a period of time, you'll start to get a percentage of how accurate it is.
Mm.
That percentage is very, very important because that's the voice you need to rely on when you're under pressure. Now, similarly, once you start to quantify these things here and you start to understand the power of this voice, you can trust that voice in every aspect, whether it's meeting a person, whether it's a business or a transactional partnership as such or a business entity, whatever it is. But the first question you got to ask yourself is, how am I honing this voice inside of me? And what is the feedback that I'm giving myself on whether I should trust it and how much I should trust it? So I like what you said that, you know what, how does it make me feel? But what you said is so powerful and you can actually extend it into every other aspect.
Hmm. There is a psychic element in sports as well. Cricketers won't talk about this openly, but in cricket circles, that's what they say about Dhoni especially and Saurav Ganguly, okay. two of our top captains. They say that these guys could predict the game and some people would attribute that to pattern recognition. But there's a limit to how much pattern recognition is possible.
Yeah.
Like Dhoni and Ganguly would be able to predict what's going to happen in the next few overs. That's yeah. what gave them success as a captain.
Yeah.
Do you have anything to say about this?
This is very, very true. And you know, the more time you spend in a game, you can actually see it. Most of the greats in most sports are able to see something very, very, so very often.
Is that just an outcome of neurological pattern recognition?
Most of the time. Remember, what the eye sees and what the brain sees are two completely different things. And in sport, it's about training the brain to see, not training the eye to see.
What's the difference?
The difference is that the brain is just seeing, for example, the brain is just seeing what the ball is doing, where the ball's landing, and the shot that's paying. That's the eye seeing. The brain is seeing the ramifications of what has happened from there. This is going to lead to this, is going to lead to this, is going to lead to that. You know, you see this very, very often. So what they're making a calculated prediction on is very, very often it'll dial down to one moment in the game when the energy is shifted. And they're able to see how that energy shift is going to play out. You know, in any field, they're able to see this. Any really, truly good expert is able to see this. And this is called a master. People ask me, who's a master? What is mastery? I said, mastery, firstly, is the repetition of a skill to the point where that skill merges with who you are. You are able to execute it to precision. And then pure mastery is when you see the entire world through that skill. That's mastery.
Perhaps Kohli and Tendulkar are masters of batting.
Yes.
Both are able to predict what's going to happen. That's why they tell younger cricketers, hey, you know, he's going to do this next. Or this is what you can expect next.
Correct. But not just cricket. It extends from beyond that, Ranveer. They are masters because if you ask a Tendulkar and if you ask a Kohli to sort any of the world's problems out in terms of maybe a pollution problem, maybe a water problem, maybe a this thing, they see the whole world through the skill. They see how this one skill, if developed, can create the resource to change this, can inspire people to do this. They can, you know, the whole world becomes through that skill. It's why is it that when you have a problem with water in Africa or AIDS in Africa, why is it that Bono goes and sings in the UK? Because He sees the whole world through that problem. He's a master of his skill, and he sees how this skill can eradicate all problems. That's pure mastery.
Okay. But you get to become a master if you can get past the lower levels of things.
Correct.
Which are the distractions, the glitz, the glamour.
Correct.
Which is why I have to take the conversation towards our final segment, which is the IPL.
Okay.
That's the criticism that a lot of younger players are facing nowadays. In cricket circles especially.
Yeah.
It's said that not too many youngsters are able to handle the glitz and glamour. Yashasvi is one guy who's broken out.
For sure.
Very intensely well. The glitz and glamour are the parties, the alcohol, the sex.
Correct.
Any other
distraction? I mean, it's not as much as you think it is. In the first couple years of IPL, it was all about that. Right now, it's not so much, you know, it's like after games, the schedule is so intense. The boys go back, they're ice bathing. There's no parties every single night. They're not going out every single night. Maybe if you got a day off, then things are happening. They're not being policed as much, but for sure, there's not these copious amounts of alcohol being drunk and parties and women coming back. It's not like what people think it was.
Perhaps because the IPL has become a stepping stone to the Indian cricket team.
Without a doubt.
It's the most important competition for so many uncapped Indian players. They know that this is where they're going to be noticed.
100%. Ranveer, the one thing that I like about the IPL and the thing that I also don't like about the IPL is the foreign players. You know, I've been in an ecosystem. I've seen where for a youngster, he knows this is a stepping stone. I could get an opportunity. It could be game one. It could be game 15. And I'm going to be prepared mentally, physically, emotionally for that game. But this IPL is just a check for the foreign guy. So, you know, whether they play or whether they don't play, they get that money. And that's not going to impact so much whether they're making their national teams or not. It does for our Indian players. It doesn't for them. So I've noticed that, you know, there's a little indifference when they walk onto the pitch with how they play. There's a little carelessness or carefreeness in how they execute their skills. And when they're not playing, then there's a massive energy dump from the entire team, from those players. And I don't find enough people speaking about this. Maybe it's because of sheer respect for the system or the players. But being in that environment, I've seen how foreign players who are not playing drain energy from a team. It's a massive, massive thing. And I feel that because of their worthiness or their status of who they are, that energy drain impacts a lot of our youngsters in the system.
Do you think it's an outcome of bad leadership at the management level?
It's very difficult to manage an IPL team because you've got multiple egos, multiple status. You've got tons of brands. You've got relationships that are beyond that of the coach. You know, players have relationships with owners, with brands, with sponsors, all sorts of things. I don't want to blame anyone because it's an extremely complex ecosystem to work in and to manage things. But I do say that right up off the bat, the rules you set in place and the framework that you set in place on day one is critically important. If you give any leeway, you're done. You know, and I see this. If you don't have a strong leader like a Dhoni who can pull things in place when things are not going well, you've got no chance of pulling that team back together. You know, how you set the framework when you start is critically important. And I would like to see foreign players being held more accountable, not to the runs or wickets they get, but to the energy they bring to a locker room and to how they nurture the youngsters in that system.
What's the beauty of the IPL?
The beauty of the IPL is that it's a platform that attracts the best talent. And the beauty of the IPL, the beauty of sport, I tell this to my Indian football team every single day, every match we play. I said, guys, we're going to walk on this pitch for 90 minutes. In 90 minutes, you're going to touch the ball for about 2.5 minutes. You're going to take one touch. That's probably about 500th of a second. In 500th of a second, you can lift an entire nation of 1.5 billion people's spirits and energy up. One ball, one shot, one bat, one dive can lift an entire nation. I remind every athlete I work with that there's very few careers in this entire world that can have this much an impact on a nation in this amount of time. It's a very, very beautiful privilege.
What's some challenges when it comes to being in an IPL team, especially for the player, psychologically speaking, that the audience doesn't understand at all? Because we're just watching the game at 8 p.m. every day. We're enjoying ourselves. It's a party for the nation for two and a half months.
Correct.
These guys have to be going through some psychological challenges.
There's a lot. One is that for the Indian youngsters, very few of people have their partners around. So 2.5 months, firstly, you're away from family, you're away from loved ones. Okay. The second one is, and they're probably used to that, but the second thing is that you are on repeat. Process is being repeated every single day. The biggest challenge is if you're not playing. If you're not in the starting 11 and the team starts doing well, you don't know when you're going to get an opportunity. And when you come to the middle or towards the latter part of the tournament and you've not had that opportunity, you know very well that you could not be bought next season or you could be traded. That could be the end of your career. You know? So there is a massive imbalance of that negative energy in the team and the positive energy of the people who are doing it and trying to raise it. This is the thing that nobody sees. Okay. Also, the dynamic and the energy play between it. You know, very often, you know, you got everyone who's trying to make a name for themselves. There's a coach who's trying to make it, the assistant coach trying to get it, the physios, the coach, everybody's trying to get a little bit of that spotlight. And when it's not being got, there's this internal tussle in there that's happening. And you need really strong management to constantly create that psychological safety in that locker room to make sure that everyone feels safe. Because why? There's a beautiful saying in sport. It's an underlying saying that no one talks about. That's why we practice every single day. The saying is that the greatest travesty on earth is getting an opportunity you're not prepared for. That's why you practice. The greatest travesty is getting an opportunity you're not prepared for. Okay. Now, when you get an opportunity, you have to be mentally, physically, and emotionally ready to take it. That's why you practice it. And that's what leadership is about. Leadership is about creating that ecosystem so that people can practice, bring everything, and that whenever you call on anyone, they're ready to take that opportunity.
What goes wrong with the guys that don't make it big in the IPL? Because even in order to be a part of a playing 11 in the Indian Premier League, you need to have performed domestically. You need to have performed in your Ranji Trophy.
Correct.
Or at least in some tournament where you get noticed.
Yeah.
So you are a champion in many ways, even if you've made it to the playing 11.
Yes.
But you'll often see either one season wonders or people who get picked up for a very large amount of money and then are never seen after that.
Yeah.
What goes wrong with those guys?
Half the time it's one is, you know, it all boils down and dials down on pressure, to be honest. But the way to help and manage these athletes, which is very, very difficult, and I've seen some really great coaches do this, is they'll get a youngster in. Firstly, you can't breed 9 youngsters. You can only breed 2 or 3 maximum, and you need your stability out there. But when you give a youngster an opportunity, firstly, the first thing you got to do is you got to tell him he's playing 24 hours in advance and not 4 hours or 3 hours before he plays. Because why? The preparation for that match starts the day before, mentally. So give him enough time to align his body and mind. Very often, it's not done like that. The team's announced or the squad's announced on the morning of the match. First thing. Second thing is, have a conversation with him and tell him, you're playing in this position. You've got 2 games or you've got 3 games. Tell him how much he has. Don't make him, there's this attitude in the IPL that every single game you're playing for your life. That shouldn't be the case. That's too much of pressure. Imagine as a podcaster, if I come and tell you every single podcast that you're going to put out there is either going to make or break your career. You know, every single, that's too much. But if all of a sudden you know I've got this amount of time and I'm going to do X amount of things, then there's a level of creativity you can bring. There's a level of personality and authenticity you can bring to play that's going to give you a better chance of success. So these are the few small things that I would love to see change. You know, I would love to see messages land in a softer way. I would love to see people be given a prolonged opportunity so that they get a fair chance to prove themselves, you know. These are the simple things that can make all the difference in the heart and mind of a young athlete.
Okay. There's been a massive amount of information that we've downloaded from you, Shyamal Vallabhji, on this episode.
Okay.
Sometimes I just get an intuition to stop.
Okay.
And I've got that intuition right okay. now. All I want to say is I think this podcast will be either titled How to Become Dhoni or How to Become Kohli. Because I personally feel to become either of those two guys, and they're very different prototypes, there's a lot of mental training at play.
Yeah.
And at the end of this episode, I feel like that's what you've done. You've explained leadership. You've explained how to be calmer. And you've explained the Kohli side of things, which I bracket as excellence and positive aggression. So thank you.
Thank you.
There's many more conversations to be had with you. But we need to do this hard stop right now.
No problem. No worries.
Because we need to leave room for the next conversation.
Thank you so much, Rami. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Lots of love. Thank you so much. That was the episode for today. Of course, Shamil's going to be back on TRS. It's very rare that I get to meet souls like Shamil Vallabhji or Dr. Luke Coutinho. These are the conversations I look forward to on a personal level, because all my questions come out of my heart when I'm talking to people like this. People who've been exposed to the best minds in the world, the best mentalities in the world. And trust me, I get extremely mentored by simply being in the presence of such people. I hope you feel the same. In fact, it's a privilege of my life that I get to share these personal mentoring sessions with you. I'm always trying to upgrade my own mentality. I'm always trying to jump up to that next level of what it means to have a strong mindset. So I hope you feel the same. And I know that the community we've built out on TRS, where we're releasing so many deep, power-packed episodes, this community that's built out is chasing knowledge. If you're someone who's chasing knowledge this aggressively, I hope that this podcast added value to your journey. Shamil Vallabhji will be back on TRS. Please drop your feedback in the comment section below, and definitely tell me what you'd like for me to speak about the next time Shamil's around. We'll be back very, very soon.